This is the Roaring Elephant Podcast, and we're back with another one of our 10-year retrospective, ultra-long, without any kind of editing, because I'm lazy episodes. And obviously, I'm not alone. I'm here with my podcast co-host, Dave. How are you doing, Dave?
I'm doing very well. But the main reason I'm doing very well, although it's always lovely to chat with you, Jan, is that are joined with us by a special guest. Yay. Our favourite special guest. We are joined once more by John Mertick, Director of Program Management at the Linux Foundation. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Every year you invite me back. Every year I'm shocked that you invite me back, but I am at the same time flattered. And then every year my kids get into our Spotify queue and find this podcast and drop it into it in the middle of a car ride of us talking, which is inordinately embarrassing just because I hate listening to my own voice, but at the same time a little bit hysterical. So, but great to always be back.
So that one download we have for our episode, that's you, that's your kids. Thank them very much.
Yes,
from both of our hearts.
Well, it happens quite a bit. So it's like one or it's like two of my kids doing it like 50 different times. So I don't know how, if you count uniques or not, of how that works. But yes,
you count unique IP downloads. So it would still only count as one, unless you have, if you do it on a roam and something like that, you said driving around, that would actually count for more. So yes, that's two downloads. Great.
Yeah. The Mertick family is doing its part.
Excellent. Excellent.
And of course, since we have John on the podcast from the Linux Foundation, this episode is going to center around what the hell happened in 10 years of open source and Linux Foundation and all that fun stuff. Things that me and Dave know, well, some stuff about, adjacent, let's say. We lived around this thing, but John, you're kind of straight smack down in the middle of the whole thing, weren't you?
I have been. It's really interesting looking back at 10 years just on a variety of different things. I mean, one of just the Linux Foundation is just an organization that, you know, has grown. You know, when I started here a little over 10 years ago, I think we were well less than 100 folks. Now we're, you know, 500, you know, folks globally. Project-wise, I was just looking through Wayback Machine. We had like 20-odd projects. Now, I think we host well over 1,000, probably close to like 1,200 different projects. So you have sort of those aspects. I think the nature, there's parts of open source that have definitely changed over time, you know, some of the technology stack aspects and things of that nature. I think the thing which is really interesting and same consistent, and I was even looking back in the Wayback Machine at the LF website back in 2015, September 13th, 2013, just to be exact, is the same message around collaboration of and doing it on a massive scale. Because, you know, that's, I think the lesson, that's what Linux showed us, that this is possible and what the actual impacts can be. And I'm really fortunate to kind of just see that play over again and again and again and again in verticals, horizontals, all over the place. It's not always exactly the same. Everyone's a little bit unique. Sometimes they see patterns. Sometimes it's never saw that before. It worked really good. Sometimes is I've seen that before and I'm surprised it's working really good, or vice versa. But I think that same message still applies. And, you know, it's a unique thing that we have seen, that if you bring the smartest minds together and you give them an open forum to collaborate on, you get really cool stuff. You get groundbreaking technologies that really push the world forward. And organizations just come to us because they see that pattern of what we enable, and they want to keep doing the same thing. So it's really fascinating.
Yeah. I'm curious, because obviously the Linux Foundation for a long time was just that. It was the Linux Foundation, and there were lots of other kind of sub-projects beneath it. But, you know, at some point, you know, the Linux Foundation spawned off multiple different sub-foundations. Obviously, like the CNCF is probably one of the most well-known. But, you know, there's the OSSF and, you know, multiple others. Like, when did, do you know when that sort of shift in mindset happened from just being sort of like a collection of sub projects to like multiple different sort of sub foundations?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting question. I mean, I think if you look at, you know, contemporaries, you know, like the Apache Software Foundation, which, you know, came around in the 90s around the Apache web server, there was a little bit of a model that was sort of drawn with that because, you know, there was a model of how that development happened. And so that began to apply to a number of different open source projects.
Yeah.
You know, the Apache way, if you would, of like, yeah, this is the model in which we did this. So if you go back in 2007, the Free Standards Group came together with the Open Source Development Labs, which is actually what formed the Linux Foundation. And the concept really at the time was, hey, let's just like try to begin to align some of these, you know, different efforts so that, you know, we can be, you know, a lot, you know, more stronger together. But I think the thing that we also began to emerge over time with all of this is that there's just so much we have learned with Linux and the same challenges, and open source itself was starting to really come from more of a grassroots hobbyist enthusiast thing to truly being embraced by organizations worldwide. I mean, I think it was about that time, maybe a little bit earlier, that, you know, IBM really put its mark out there of just saying its commitments behind open source were and the investments it was making. We saw a number of business models that were built around open source. Most of them were sort of built more around kind of more of a commercial aspect, kind of like a freemium-esque model. But you were still starting to see some of that emergence happening. But I think the one lesson that what we started to see happening out there was groups and industries began to realize that this was the way to accelerate getting forward. You know, the path before that these groups would align each other was, you know, strictly kind of either around industry trade groups or standards development. And those processes, you know, they have a lot of definitely strong merits to them, but, you know, at the same token, at the pace that digital technology was looking to move, open source was a faster accelerant because you came out with an end product already. Like, you were building what you needed along the way. You weren't building a thing that could build a thing, right?
Yeah.
And so I think it changed a lot of that paradigm. And, you know, and we saw that came together some of our earliest umbrellas. You know, automotive grade Linux is a great example.
Mm.
You know, those car manufacturers at the time came together and said, hey, like, we realize the world has, the world of buying an automobile has changed. It's not horsepower anymore. It's now moved to the technology gizmos and gadgets we have in here. And those main auto manufacturers quickly realized they're becoming software companies more than anything. And so their thought is like, well, how do we keep the pace of this and not be a situation, whereas before they were licensing a lot of this technology, how could they be at more of the driver's seat to it? And that's where automotive grade Linux really was born around this concept. You know, we saw similar things in the networking space. You know, when the 5G rollout was being really pushed, there was a lot of struggles of sort of going through a traditional standards process, considering the timelines and things they had coming together. And so we saw a number of organizations like AT&T and others that came together as like, well, let's just build the infrastructure as a collective open source because we all are going to need it. And so that really, you know, pushed out a number of those networking projects at the time. That collectively came together under sort of the LF networking umbrella. So it's been really, really interesting that, and I think even when I was first talking with a lot of projects, you know, back in 2015 around the Linux Foundation, you know, we'd say, you know, we've learned a lot from open source over time. And what our goal is to say, how can we help support these new initiatives and these new industries that are just coming to the idea that they're going through a digital transformation of some nature, and they're coming into the crossroads of how do we attack it? Do we do it the same traditional ways we've done always of vendors build products, we buy products, you know, bada bing, bada boom, or do we take a stronger, you know, do we realize that like the software is so crucial for us that we need to kind of help be more at the driver's seat, which is sort of where the open source model comes in and drives a lot of value.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, I have to say, I mean, you haven't mentioned the Open Mainframe project once, and it's actually also celebrated as 10 years anniversary.
It is, it is.
August, if I remember correctly.
We have a couple projects at 10 years. Like, we have CNCF at 10, we have Open Mainframe project, we have CNCF at 10 years. We have Yocto, I think last year was 10 years. And so, and I think next year we're going to have a few more, but yeah, we've seen a lot of 10 years, like 10 years of 10 years of anything in technology is like an epic, right? You know, it's not like, oh, 10 years, what do you do? Like it's 10 years is a long time. Now for the mainframe industry, like where they count things over decades, that might not be significant, but they've also had a lot longer of lineage to kind of come up to this point. But yeah, I mean, you know, Jan, just you know, let's just skip to the chase here and talk Open Mainframe project. If that's the angle we want to go down, we can do that.
It's the future, right? Come on.
I mean, it's the only thing that's going to be left. It's mainframes and cockroaches. They'll outlive us all.
It's certainly seeming that way. It's certainly seeming that way. No, it's really exciting. I mean, that is, I've talked about this community quite a bit before because I think they're one of the most fascinating communities. Because of sort of the longevity of it, and because like we've seen just generational that's starting to play, I think there's some technology communities now that are getting into that generational aspect of it, but mainframe has beat them to it. Like they started in the 50s. Most of these other communities at best were probably like, you know, 90s, maybe 80s. Yeah. So we're now starting to get into the generational aspect on those. But you know, they've been really fascinating because, you know, that community's always had a sense of collaboration, and having this as a project together has been this opportunity to really rekindle so much of that was already there. And we've just seen, you know, tons of companies, tons of individuals who have just sort of jumped in and just said, hey, wow, like we want to collaborate on stuff. We have cool ideas. Like we want to bring these, you know, things forward. And and I think the 10-year culmination of sort of where we at is really a testament to that community having to drive. Because I mean, it's something I tell like a lot of our team members is, you know, the people that have to want these open source projects the most are the people in these communities. Like our role at the LF is being their guides and helping them get there. But the spirit of deeply wanting it is these communities. And the mainframe communities is that. Like they're the exemplar of that. Like they've wanted it for 60 some years, and they're wanting to pass it off to the next people. They're going to want it for another 60 some years and more. So,
yeah.
Until it's just the cockroaches left, I suppose. And maybe they'll teach the cockroaches to care too. I don't know.
I was really, really curious. You mentioned the ASF like, towards the beginning there.
Yeah.
And I was doing a little bit of digging around, it's probably a couple of months ago now, and it sort of, you know, back when we started this podcast, obviously this was you know, originally very much focused around kind of big data, and the ASF played a huge part in the big data ecosystem. Mm-hmm. It feels like, you know, I was looking at what are the most active ASF projects today, and it seems like the ASF nowadays is, at least it's like a lot of the most active stuff is kind of libraries and stuff like consumed by developers versus kind of, you know, core applications that people are using. In stark contrast to the Linux Foundation and the various kind of child foundations beneath it, that seems to have very much taken up that, you know, that charge for a lot of today's, I don't know, anything, like whether it's, you know, modern cloud infrastructure, or there's so much that sort of now seems to have gravitated more to the Linux Foundation and its child foundations. Do you think there's a particular reason behind that, behind sort of why that shift seemed to have happened? Or do you even recognize that as being a thing that has happened?
I mean, I think overall we have seen open source be most successful at the commoditization level, if you would. And that, and I don't mean that as sort of like a derogatory term, but I sort of mean it as, you know, if we look at technology stacks, I mean, go back more, I mean, go back, you know, 30 years ago, even almost 30 years ago, when we were talking virtualization, it was synonymous with VMware, right? And that quickly, that level became commoditized. And then we've seen like much of the infrastructure side become commoditized and so on and so forth. So like the whole cloud stack has slowly got to that point. And, you know, we're seeing the same patterns on a lot of different other areas, you know, as well, especially, you know, web development technologies, you know, I mean, who does cold fusion anymore, right? And you know, that was the thing of the 90s. I can date myself by stating that out loud. You know, so much of all of those stacks have went to be open collaborative, right? So I think overall, you know, the early days and of open source and then free software, we saw a lot of interest of like, well, how can we create the free alternative to fill in the blank commercial product?
Yeah.
There is a bunch of that still. And there's tons of those project community that are adding some value, and some of them are, you know, frankly, just really excellent pieces of software. But I think where we're seeing so much of the gravity come together is where are the areas that these different competing groups or different organizations or different people can agree on that is sort of like a common layer, and how can we bring our smarts together to make those common layers stronger, right? I mean, I was reading something the other day about, you know, go back 40 years and like how many variants of Unix were out there, right? And now it's Linux and, yeah, you know, some of the BSD variants, and I guess we can call OS X it too, but you know, whatever. How much left out there is there? I mean, not much Solaris, not ran into an HP UX install very recently. You know, AIX is not quite as much of a thing from my understanding. And so we, again, we've seen sort of, and even as we've seen like new devices and things that came up, like, I mean, I've been, you know, playing with a project called Thingino, which is, does firmware for Ingenic CPU cameras that you can, like, you know, security cameras and things like that, that you can buy off of like Amazon and AliExpress and things like that. I mean, that's all Linux. Like they've built their entire, you know, build rid of Linux, which actually has made it really easier for that project to kind of go do a bunch of reverse engineering to kind of untie those cloud features, but that's a whole other topic. But what I've seen is like, that's become sort of the commodity layer. Like you need an OS, Linux or something like it is probably gonna be your base of where you're gonna start from. And so that has been a natural thing for technologies overall. So I guess to your earlier question of like where things are floating, a lot of it really depends upon sort of the governance model and what you're looking to do. And we tell projects that all the time to come to us of saying, hey, like help us understand what you're looking to accomplish, help us understand the goals you're after, the collaboration you're after and things like that. There's a lot of situations where, you know, the Apache way model is exactly what they want, is exactly what they're after, and you know that is an area to develop. There's, you know, sometimes there's a lot of areas where the Linux Foundation is a great model. There's, you know, models where maybe doing their own thing or maybe just not doing anything at all is sometimes a great model. I mean, it just really all depends. So I mean, I would say it's probably maybe more reflective on some of the market in there. I think the other aspect is there's a big recognition that making open source is more than just the technology aspects, but all of the other aspects around it. Like we want to build community, we want to build ecosystems, you know, we want to enable and train folks on these technologies. We want to drive outreach, events, things of that nature. We need somebody just to sit next to us and help us through these things. You know, the LF model really leans itself very nicely because we have all of those disciplines in-house that we can lean on. So it's a little bit of the changing nature there. I mean, I think unfortunately we've also kind of seen some situations in Apache projects where there were organizations that sort of went that model with it. And I don't think we're probably as aligned with the intention or understanding of what they longer term wanted to do with it. And those have all blown up in weird forks or, you know, bizarre license choices and these BSL and all these sort of other things. You know, some of them have spurned out into new projects to get around that. But I think that's also just been kind of an unfortunate thing where I think, and I think maybe that's just been a part of our overall open source journey as a technology society overall, is that we've kind of had to come to grips with how that looks and what that's all about. I mean, you know, the freemium, you know, open core model of the aughts is gone away completely. I mean, it's probably still out there if you look hard enough, but that's no longer like looked at as like a legit business model, or at least a competitive one, right? And I think that's been a bit of a struggle in some areas. So I don't know. I mean, I think all of these groups in all these ways, depending upon what you're trying to accomplish, there's a merit for all of them. Probably where we have seen on the Linux Foundation is like, we just have a ton of the expertise that can help fill in all the areas that a community needs. Outside of writing code, we don't write code. We're not interested in writing code. You don't want to see John Murtick's code. There's some of it on GitHub. It's not that great. Self-taught Python programmer, former PHP programmer. So, hold the tomatoes. I think it's a little bit of that, of just sort of where our technology society has gone.
Personal
question. Something I've been waiting to happen and it just doesn't happen. I mean, I would love to have Linux phones. And that's not something Apache can do, because that's more than a library. That is something that a community just get together. So every year that we had John on the podcast, I was hoping to be able to talk about the Linux Foundation, Android clone, Linux phone, whatever it's called. But for some reason, nobody's actually either interested or it's too complicated. I mean, if you can't talk about that, that's fine. It's totally fine.
But... There's been a ton of projects over time that have tried this. This is nothing new.
Nothing from the LF, nothing that was that's big enough to really be able to push something like this forward.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interest. The whole thing is, I think that is sort of a weird sort of market dynamic that has really come to pass. And I think that is an industry where we have seen so much convergence on Android, particularly as a technology stack, which again is built on Linux. So I guess,
yeah, exactly.
You could make that sort of your longer term argument of all of that.
But it's not a community, right? Android is not a community anymore. It's tyrannically driven by Google. And we're seeing at the moment some problems around that emerging, to be honest.
Yeah.
So,
I think all of these things become complex over time. That industry also has a lot of dynamics on, regulatory, pieces and things of that. There's just a lot that is, I think, still coming to grips of what all of this means and, how things sort of move forward. And it's also a very hotly contentious, area as well. So it's a little bit of a tricky one that, to your point, it's not been without trying. Intel's had some projects. I think some of them have at one time floated in out of the Linux Foundation, but none of them have really got the traction that were really needed to get there. And there's been also other commercial efforts. Palm OS and, I think there was a BOS clone at one point and things like that. There's been other folks. BlackBerry's kind of completely gone off the face of the planet. So, it's not been without trying. It's just, that is just there are market dynamics of the way how it works. To your point, there are some of the underlying principles that are changing. So it'll be interesting what the future holds for that.
I was kind of hoping the car project would take it up as well, because the whole automotive and mobile is kind of, especially on the technology front, is really merging into each other with a lot of bad things coming out at the moment.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think there's a lot of hesitation on that front. Because we've even seen the push for Apple, CarPlay Ultra, I think they had, and just controlling every part of your automobile has sort of freaked manufacturers out. And probably not for exactly the same reason of messing things up more than just sort of ecosystem control and things like that. But irregardless, it's a complex area.
See, that's exactly it. I mean, it's the control and the thing that the LF and the community and the open source idea can bring is that it's a community together without a desire to exert control over the thing, which makes multiple parties willing to work together, which yep. in this area. Oh, well, I guess this year will not be the year of the Linux phone, I guess.
It may not be. And to be honest, I think, you know, the one thing I think it's important for to know about sort of the LF is we are responsive to the groups that come to us that want to build these technologies. Like we don't like, you know, churn up in the back of our head is like, how about a foundation of this? How about a foundation of this? Like all of our projects and stuff, we have vendors and enthusiasts and groups that are coming to us and saying, hey, we're seeing this as an opportunity. We have these players potentially at the table. And even of our larger foundations that have like umbrellas and sub projects within there. I mean, that's the genesis of all of those as well. I mean, there's some of them that there's some seed development that's happened. It's kind of like helping connect the dots, but it's more of there's the drive out there. So I think I think the push I would say out there is like, hey, if there is the interest and there's vendors and folks that would want to try to do this, like, you know, come together and have conversations. Like we're always open for conversations, and you know, we kind of create the host of these things. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's hope they're listening.
They might be. You never know who's listening, you know? I mean, we talked about maybe my kids are like playing my podcast in front of them too. Who knows?
I think the mobile industry is a particularly tricky one for something like this to break into. There is actually as you might expect, a Wikipedia page of a list of open source mobile phones. And I do actually have, experience with at least one of them back in, let's see, when was it? Back in 2015. Ubuntu Touch was an Ubuntu spin released for a couple of phones, and it is still a thing today. It's purely community driven. It only works on like very weird, esoteric, low performance, like fairly crappy experience hardware. But it is still a thing that you can run should you want to. And there've been a number of things like the Furry Phone and the Fairphone are probably the two that are most well known in the space. But it's, you know, whenever you look at them, because I'm sort of, yeah, I'm kind of OSS phone curious, I would say. But whenever I look at them, like the performance of them compared to, you know, a modern phone is always terrible. The battery life is always horrendous, and the just generally like the user experience is pretty poor, and we're just so used to having like such a vibrant ecosystem around our handheld devices nowadays that it's very, very difficult for kind of new players to come into this space. And you know, web apps will get you so far, but there's a lot of things that, you know, don't work through a web app experience, and that's where a lot of these things tend to suffer. That combined with the fact that you're getting all of these sort of, you know, negatives, and then they end up being hideously expensive as well.
Yeah.
So
they also don't work anymore because banking apps are now relying on the security libraries from Google or Apple. So if you have a non Apple or Android phone, you just can't use your banking apps. And it's not because they have to, it's just because it's made easy for banks to use that stuff, because then for them they can say, oh, we're using this thing, if it's broken, it's their problem, not ours.
Yeah.
But that does mean that I think from now on it's going to be even worse.
Yeah. I think it's absolutely right. Absolutely right. So, John, I'm sort of curious around, like, one of the things that you mentioned when we were reflecting on 10 years of the Linux Foundation is like this focus on collaboration has been a consistent theme throughout. What are some of the things that have you think of like change, apart from the normal kind of growth and scale and doing more and that sort of thing, what are some of the things that have changed in the Linux Foundation over the last 10 years, do you think?
I think with growth, I mean, like you said, there's just the natural of us building, you know, more disciplines and things like that out there in our staffing here. I also look at a lot of the vertical growth focus that we have seen over the years, just in projects. You know, I work in the energy industry and the motion picture industry projects, but we have a number of other ones. And I think those have been very, very fascinating ones to really dig in and just learn a ton about and understand kind of the impacts that those, you know, groups are having. I think we have continued to see sort of on our events front of, looking at, you know, how to differentiate, you know, what LF events look like and events for our projects looks like, you know, versus, you know, where you might see in other places. I think we do a really, really, really good job of really focusing our events that we're doing on the developers themselves, because we see them where a lot of like, you know, trade groups and things like that sort of, you know, see events as kind of like a sales revenue marketing activity. And certainly, like, you know, we have sponsorships and things like that. But I think overall, the goal that we see across the board is that we see when communities get together, it adds tremendous value to them. And we see the innovation cycle, kick off. So I think that has been kind of an interesting aspect in there. You know, bringing in, I think the other things is, you know, we've really had a bigger focus on continuing to grow out sort of like education and research. And number of areas. I think our research arm is doing some phenomenal work on just building more data around open source, which just didn't exist out there 10 years ago. And so we've really established that as a really nice area. And I think our education group has, you know, where it was really very much focused, you know, around Linux education and certification, things like that. We've seen that grow out into a number of areas that have complemented the technologies we have out there as a whole. I think even what it means to do outreach and, you know, the dirty word of marketing, if you would, into open source communities, we've seen just a lot of evolution of what that looks like. And, you know, really based upon what we hear from these various constituents, because, I mean, at the end of the day, everything we do is designed to support these communities. So we take a lot of the feedback that we're hearing very seriously and use that as a way to, you know, to curtail. I mean, we design these things to specifically work around, you know, each of these groups. So I think that's been, a big focus shift. But like I said, a lot of the underlying principles are very much the same, you know. Yeah. You know, push your collaboration, you know, focusing on the code aspect of things. We have seen a growth of on the standards development side. In the last 10 years, I think the Joint Development Foundation came in several years ago. And so we've started to see a lot of complements where it was before, you know, if I go back 10 years ago, there was still kind of a little bit of a standards versus open source sort of, friction. And we're starting to see more and more now of a complementary aspect to it. So we're seeing, you know, open source projects, not just necessarily in the, you know, spec plus reference implementation aspect, but also where you have open source projects, but then you also have specification, other sort of componentry that is sort of designed on like the extension side of things. So we've seen that start to build out in a way that also embodies the same spirit of open source at the same time. So it's not, you know, specification development, you know, the way that our granddaddies might have done it. It's more really in line with, you know, how do GitHub flows and, you know, how do we do modern development on our way here, but kind of mirroring that with the standards experience. And we've seen some really neat opportunities where standards we may not have formed before just because of like the hill to get over, that has really come around. So Yeah, it's really interesting. It's always like some things are the same, some things are different. Like Spirit is very consistent. Like I think it's the phenomenal thing over 10 years. I mean, talk of any technology area that in 10 years the underlying, you know, spirit and emphasis has stayed the same. I think in open source you go back farther than that, obviously, but just with the LF of our focus, like I think that's been just so tried and true.
Yeah. It's a good sign that the core values that existed 10 years ago still resonate today. It's a great sign that it was built with a lot of the right kind of focus in mind.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, and we learn a lot from those that precede us. I mean, everything we've learned from the Linux kernel, we learned from many of, you know, those early projects out there. We learned from the other efforts that we see in broad open source and other groups. And I think vice versa, they, you know, learn a lot. And then, you know, I think we're getting to that area where, you know, groups are, you know, there's just multiple different ways of how you would want to, you know, manage sort of an open source strategy. And, you know, the Linux Foundation is a big chunk of that. But, you know, at the same time, there's multiple ways to do this. And sometimes there's just different models that fit better. We've just happened to really hit a lot just because of the expertise we have on the back end.
Yeah.
There's also a book about open source strategy somewhere, somehow, that somebody written at some point.
I mean, yeah, some jerk wrote it. I don't know if I agree with anything he put in it, but, you know,
one thing we talked about.
People buy the thing, though. I'm pretty impressed. I get a trickling of things in there, and I have seen it in two book clubs now. I saw one maybe two years ago, you know, with a bunch of open source program offices somewhere in Europe. Some of the leads in that were doing it. And the end of last year, one of my colleagues sent me a picture that was in a Chinese book club, which I am blown away. First of all, I never knew there was a Mandarin translation, so that's number one.
Oh, wow.
But maybe it looked at you, I don't know.
But I hope it was an official one.
I'm sure it was. I trust the people at PAC to have handled that. But number two, it sort of shows that, you know, I guess to me it's always sort of like a wow, like look at an impact that you've made with that, which is sort of like the whole goal of like doing a book for the third time, of like maybe this one will stick and maybe this one, you know, will be of something of some lasting value. So hey, you know, maybe we'll get some good value out of it. Maybe there's some good lessons that people can learn from it.
I think it's good timing. As you said, open source isn't about developing, well, still about developing, of course, a big deal, but a lot more open standards, open APIs, and just open project structures. It's all part of the whole thing now.
Mm-hmm.
About a year ago, we had a discussion. You weren't there, I think. It was just Dave and me, about how it was harder to get young people involved, and that the average age of the open source committer was getting old and gray, and going the wrong side of the age gap. Is LF looking at this, as in we've done this for 10 years now ish doing it certain ways? There appears to be a somewhat of a disconnect between the new generations and open source. Is this something that lives with the LF, something that you look at, something that you have programs around, or more of a wait and see? Or,
well, I mean, I think one, there is, with the current AI climate out there, the at least in the United States, the huge push around STEM education has kind of appeared to come in a little bit of conflict there. So I think we have an interesting headwinds that we're sort of dealing with on that front. But I mean, I kind of stick that aside. You know, the LF has always had a huge emphasis on education. You know, we've had not only just all of our, you know, conferences and events, but we have a whole education arm that just drives out a ton of content, much of it free content. And, you know, so I think there's been just a huge focus on that part. I think within the project communities, what one thing has really become very front and center is that there's only so much capacity for a maintainer to take on work for a long period of time. You know, the XZ vulnerability is like the poster child example of that. You know, maintain, and I know it's been talked to death, but you know, to give you the TLDR, overworked maintainer, I'll say ambitious, but probably more aggressive contributor wanting to help. They're kind of at the break's end, says sure. That person turns out they had bad intent and were really sneaky how they pulled stuff off. You know, boom, we have an Easter surprise. And I think more and more that we've seen out there, there's huge challenges continuing. I mean, I think at the time that was really in the peak of sort of the maintainer burnout thing. And I don't think a lot of that has necessarily changed at all. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one thing that we try to work with a lot of key project communities is starting to do that look ahead of saying like, what does the future look like for this? Like, you know, who are sort of the parties that are involved? Like, how do you begin developing out those next groups and those next contributors that build into maintainers and things like that? So I think, you know, legacy planning is something that I think open source projects, you know, kind of have struggled with. Cause I mean, if you think about it, I often think about it very much in a parallel of like a startup context. Like, what startup out there thinks about their legacy thing, right? They're thinking as far as like, how do I get to the next round of funding? And past then of like, how do I get to cash this again? Like, that is maybe their legacy plan. Okay.
Come on. There's step probably one of starting something new is not figuring out how to die.
I mean, we all have different ways of thinking what death looks like. But anyways, you know, so I think a lot of that is just driven, and it's not driven with like malfeasance. Like, it's just driven with excitement. And I think more mature institutions begin to think in a much more sustainable life cycle. I mean, if you go to like a Fortune 500 company, the second a board approves a new CEO, they're already thinking about the succession plan. Like, they're already thinking of who the next one is, right? You know, I serve on our local school board, and you know, we just elected a new superintendent, or we just hired a new superintendent. And before that, we were already thinking of like, what does of the current superintendent, what did, you know, transition and things like that look like, you know, for him. And the same thing is that we start to look down the road is the overall staff and the climate there of like, what does that look like? When you have that well planned out, it becomes very orderly. I mean, as it turns out, school boards, in at least in Ohio, are really responsible. Their biggest two responsibilities are hiring a superintendent and a treasurer. And as it turns out, both of them we had to replace within, you know, 6 months, actually 4 months to be exact. But we had such a great already plan and track in place that we were able to kind of execute on that realm. So I put that sort of in the context here because I think in open source, because there's so much focus on the code and just the here and now and developing out and keeping up with technology hype cycles and life cycles and things like that, that those things just fall to the background. They fall to, you know, the next person's, the next day's, the next year, the next month's problem. And so we try to help spend time with these communities to get them to begin to think about some of these challenges and what those look like and how do you get ahead of those and how do you begin to develop that out. On the flip side of it, you know, we never like to hear it, but sometimes these projects have, you know, just end of life cycle. I mean, all these things have life cycles, and one of the healthy stages, back to your comment of death, you know, Johan, is sometimes projects are just done. Like, pack it up. It's okay. We've moved on. It's been a great run. You know, the maintainers have gone on. The market has went on. Things like that have changed. I mean, I went through that with ODPI a few years ago. You know, there's other projects that I've helped guide through that same thing. You know, some of them came with a lot of promise and never lived up to it. Some of them lived up to what they needed to. It's just, it arcs its way down. So I think that's another honest conversation that we have with a number of communities of like, what truly does this longer term path look like? And what does this longer, you know, play look like? And, you know, what are sort of those signs out there that we need to be aware of and helping plan? And those are difficult conversations to have, but I think are sort of just as important in the whole aspect of things.
Yeah.
completely brought the room down with that. Everyone's like, oh geez, John, way to kill the podcast.
No, it's a real challenge. There's no easy fix for, and there's no sign on the horizon that anything is changing drastically in that space. Mm-hmm. I suppose maybe a sort of a related question is, when you think about the developer communities that make up so many of these different projects, like, have you seen the communities themselves sort of change over 10 years, either, I don't know, in the ways that they communicate, or like the makeup of those communities, or like, you know, anything along those kind of lines?
I mean, I think, one of our big things was always pushing out mailing lists for projects when they started off. I look at the average mailing list for all of our projects, and it's a bit of a ghost town. And now we see synchronous communication, a lot of it on Slack. I think we're seeing communities look at different tooling there, but, you know, things like Zulip, Discord, although Discord is probably going to be back in the Slack situation in another couple of years, but we'll kick that can down the road. So I think we've seen a little bit more on that. I think the decentralized concept of a lot of these communities, you know, has always been a thing, but I think it's kind of came a little bit more to the forefront now that, just as a society, we are more comfortable with remote working. And just, you know, having colleagues you work with that you've maybe never met in person before, or maybe see once or twice in a couple of years. So those are just real realistic things that have changed a lot of the landscape there. I think overall a lot of like the software engineering principles and things like that have not changed as much. Those, you know, seem to be very, you know, core, very similar. I think just a lot of the mechanisms and things like that have really, and some of the tooling has moved on a lot. And I think we've just seen like tooling advance to the point where it's become less friction, you know, than before. I mean, imagine submitting a patch, you know, to an open source project like 20 years ago. Like, you're making a diff file, you're sending it to a mailing list. All of this jazz, and now it's like, oh god, I have to do a pull request, shoot me now. Like, I mean, it's like, kids, you have no idea how hard it used to be. Like, there were large Fortune 500 companies in technology that I will leave the names out of, but if you were one of those companies, you know this is the case, that if you got a line of code accepted into a major open source project like the Linux kernel, you got paid a bonus. And it wasn't because it was that hard to write the code, it was that much of a pain in the ass to actually submit these things, not just for the project, but also your own internal compliance processes. Turns out most of those companies don't have that anymore because it's really easy. So it's not such a big deal, but it speaks to the fact of, like, you know, there's been the frictions have been removed in a lot of areas, which again, maybe coming back to your earlier point of like getting the young kids in, maybe it's a reflection on that because young kids are lazy. I don't know. I mean, that's, I've got four kids. I kind of wonder sometimes, and I'm joking. but I mean, I think it's just sort of the where these groups are sort of needing to go and what they're out to do. So I think that's been, I think, a lot of the evolution. And there's been a number of companies that have came with great tooling and stuff, and some even open source projects that have really focused on like how to improve that experience.
Yeah, this is a bit of my old man get off my lawn thing that I have. We make everything easy.
Those kids don't get it anymore, do they?
Everything needs to have an easy button. And the problem is that when it's easy, you don't think about it anymore. When I do my schoolwork, I do the exercises not because they're fun, because they're horrible, but because by repetition, by doing things again and again, you get through the tough parts and you understand why things happen the way they are. And yes, in the olden days, it took an arm and a leg to get a line submitted. But at least you only did it if your line was worthwhile, because it was effort. Effort was required. So quality kind of came as a side effect, not always, but quite often. And today, with all of the vibe coding, my hair stands up on the back of my neck when I hear people talk about that. And sure, for some things, it's perfect. I need a small website to have some CSV file put on a website. Sure, you don't want to put effort in there. but that's just a hobby thingy. People are using the easy button for very serious production quality, surgery, things like that. Again, it's my get off my lawn old guy ranting coming up, but I don't think this is a good evolution. I think some things should stay hard so it attracts a kind of person that is willing to put in the effort.
I mean, my son is taking algebra for calc this year, and he's great at math. He's having, and this has been a course that's kind of kicked his butt a little bit. And it's not because of the subject necessarily being hard, but it's the skills required to be successful at it have changed, right? And I was talking to the teacher of it, and he was telling me that he's like, this is a common thing where students at this level, they begin to hit that area where it's like, hey, before I was smart enough, I don't need to study. I can just do these things. Now the table has changed. Now this is the first opportunity that these kids are learning to study, and it becomes a huge challenge for them. And they come out of it very strong. Like, they come out of it with the right skills, but it's sort of that leap that you have to go through there. And I know we've been talking to my son, one of the things on there is like, you know, they aren't necessarily graded on the answer, but they're also graded on the process of how they get to the answer, which is just as important. So I do think there are, with everything in here, and I think we're hiding the overall term of AI in here, of being the devil in disguise hiding out there. But I think with everything, there always is going to be a shift back to like the art form of how these things come together. And like the real skilled people that are great at it are always going to be in demand for the situations that, you know, need it. I mean, you know, in the, you know, around us here, you know, you can go, if you want to put kitchen cabinets in your house, you can go buy Craftmade ones or IKEA ones, and they'd be perfectly fine. If you have a nice house and you want nice cabinets, you go talk to a custom cabinet builder that does this and does it as an art and really has something that shines. Not all these things need it, but there are things that, like, geez, like, this is well thought out of how you're doing it. And so there's big thought put into it. You know, I talk even with a lot of our colleagues as we're like thinking about like our own efficiencies and things like that. And I even tell them, it's like, let's focus on making the easy things easy. Like, the easy button is great for easy things. Let it just be for that. Everything hard, it's okay for it to be hard. Let's be hard, but let's not focus on trying to make the hard easy. Let's get the easy easy, because that's the low-hanging fruit. So yeah, I mean, with all of these things, it's like, great technology. I have this wild idea. This technology is going to solve all these hard problems out here. It might solve one of them if you're lucky. And so be it. But, you know, even in AI, like the best use cases we are seeing emerge are on boring crap that nobody wants to do. And I think that is testament to where you sort of, you know, see sort of the easy button argument and things like that. I mean, hell, I mean, we thought programmers were going to be out of business when Visual Basic 6 came out, right? And that didn't happen. So, I mean, if we survive Visual Basic, what else can we survive?
It did actually make me rethink my future. And before then, I was like developer, programmer. That's kind of what I want to do. That's kind of fun. They'll need me forever. And it's around that time when those things came up and whole Visual Studio, Visual Builder, connecting thingies with arrows came up that I thought, hang on, that's not what I want to do. And I kind of broadened my horizon. So sometimes it's a good thing that things like this come along.
See? I mean, there you go. And as it turns out, I think somebody rebuilt all of the Visual Basic 6, I think I saw it, a GitHub project or something, like rebuilt it in JavaScript or something like that. But anyways, everything's rebuilt in JavaScript from our childhood. So
the one thing I'm very happy that died is UML diagrams. UML was horrible.
It is, but it still lives out there somewhere.
No, it's gone. It's no longer, that's no longer.
I'm going to like find an example of it, and then you're going to be like sending cease and desist letters to these people afterwards. Like,
so we've been looking back over the last 10 years, over the last episode, where do you think, you know, open source will go in the next 10 years? Like, what would you like to see happen? I know Jon would like to see Linux mobile phones in the next 10 years, but Jon, from your side, like, where do you see the open source kind of ecosystem and movement kind of evolving over the next decade?
So I hate to make predictions, even though folks always trick me into trying to make predictions. I trigger the Brian Windhorst clause of things there. It's been super fascinating. I mean, I feel very much honored, lucky, blessed, pick the term du jour of being able to be around this for so long and seeing all of this and just being a participant and still, people coming out to me and asking me questions on things and, you all continuing to invite me on this podcast and all of that. Like, I feel very humbled by this, seeing all of this come through. So it's very fascinating to kind of see how that's all evolved. I look forward and, say, hey, open source is a bright future still ahead of it. There's more collaboration opportunities that are still out there that we haven't scratched the surface of or whatnot. And I think what we're going to start to see is sort of more of that permutation into other vertical industries that are sort of struggling with these same sort of leaps. I mean, if anything, I think AI has sort of been that next inflection point to get folks to be rethinking their entire technology approach, stack, strategy. And it's been kind of, thrown out. I mean, every one of the projects that I work with, every one of the foundations and ecosystems I work with, all of them are discussing their AI strategies. All of them have been doing it for 2 years now. Most of them have been bringing out work or starting to line or things like that as a part of it. But it's a common theme that we're continuing to see there. And I think that's going to bring out of the woodwork more opportunities on open collaboration. Because we kind of talked about a little bit earlier, open source succeeds the most at really those areas where are just considered like the commodity, the building blocks, the things that we all need to be successful. We all need to build great technology. And, that's AI is just really just opening that back up of saying, like, what does that look like for our industry? Like, what are areas that, geez, this could help us out quite a bit and could take away things that none of us want to be doing and none of us want to solely be in the business of. So I think that's going to be one big focus area. And, I really see a really bright future on the security landscape as well. I mean, we're seeing so much investment, not just in the project, but also, mind share and thought leadership and expertise and tooling that is just going into how to make sure that, open source projects have great models and ways to operate in a landscape that will help them produce more secure and respond, to security vulnerabilities faster. I mean, some of the stuff coming out of the OpenSSF in the last year or two has just been phenomenal. If you haven't checked a lot of it out, their best practices group is just built great guides that any open source maintainer should be reading and thinking about. And I just refer a lot of our projects to them as they're starting to think about it. So I think that is going to be a continued front, that we're going to see in here. I am curious in sort of where the old AI trend on all of this sort of goes. I've seen enough of these. We all want to call it hype cycles, and hype cycles then kind of come with this sort of derogatoriness, which, I mean, probably they've all earned it, so it's not wrong. I sort of see as sort of like what is the mean that these things revert to, and what is the true opportunities that come of it? And so much, there is a bunch of noise that's happening in there, but at the same token, there's much, much more of great, interesting work that is coming from it that is going to be a true benefit. A couple of years ago at one of the Academy Software Foundation events, and this was like literally like 2 months after ChatGPT was a thing, and then everyone just started to become scared shitless of AI. I think a person from Weta Digital, I forget the gentleman's name, but he did a great talk on the impact of AI within, you know, the creatives industry. And the way that he positioned it as, you know, of looking back at past sort of technology milestones, and they all were looked at a lot in the fear area of, is X going to take the place of me? And never in those cases that it did it, what it did make is make you be better at what you're doing, right? I mean, you know, when you would go from like, from folks back then that did hand draw, you know, just did hand drawing to, you know, computer aided and things like that, you know, drawing to, you know, just some of the tools and even just sort of the, you know, the analog tools that people were using, like as those began to evolve, you know, there were all of those fears there of, oh my God, are we losing all of this? And the reality is they actually made those people just work a lot more efficiently because some of that crap they just didn't want to do. So I think that's going to be a real, that's really where the magic is in those sort of things. And it kind of really nicely parallels a little bit of like the success of open source at sort of the commoditization level of, you know, how can we work better together on things we all need that aren't differentiating so that we can all focus on the unique stuff that make us different and make us valuable.
Yeah. I must admit, I do often refer to those things as hype cycles.
I mean, we all do, all right? It's a term we're all used to. We just also look at it negatively, and I'm always conscious of that a little bit because it puts it down. Not that the term has not been earned. I don't want to say that it's like we've all had a malfeasance. These folks have earned it, but you know. Anyways, sorry. Continue.
Yeah, but I was going to say I think. Yeah, if to put a more positive spin on, you know, all of these kind of different trends that have, you know, cropped up over time, you know, waves of innovation or, you know, inflection points of innovation would be perhaps a more positive way to kind of frame them, because each one of them has fundamentally changed either the world itself or at very least the world in technology. So I think that's in my mind, at least it's a nice way to kind of frame these things as they've rolled on through our world here.
Yeah. And they all stick to some degree. I mean, it's just sort of a matter of like where it fits in and like, where is sort of the reality of it. I mean, we've went through this with web, cloud, you know, pick basically any major technology over the last couple decades, and they've all went through this. It's nothing new. It's more of a matter of, yes, these are game-changing technologies, not to, you know, use all those sort of like, you know, fancy marketing terms, but they really are changing fundamental natures of things. It's a matter of, this is an experimental phase to kind of figure out where it all fits in. Doesn't help that there's plenty of the people who want to throw money at these problems, which gets everyone all whacked out, I suppose. But it's very much a stage where we're all sort of figuring it out some, and we're finding some challenges. We're finding some great successes too, and we're also finding ways that like how can we all grapple with this and work together to help build a better collective means to do this.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I mean, it's funny that you mentioned earlier that we keep inviting you back.
And you're ready to stop that, aren't you?
Well, yes,
you mentioned that, John? But
not in the way that our audience might think. So we are actually, and we had mentioned this to you before we invited you and before we started recording. So it's not that we're springing this on John. Don't worry, dear audience. But you know, as part of this 10 years, we are actually concluding the podcast at its 10-year anniversary. And, you know, this session with you, as it goes out, is actually our penultimate episode. So there's one more to come. But I just, you know, wanted to say that it has been amazing chatting with you over the years. And I certainly hope that we won't be strangers.
I hope not either. It's always an honor. I always look forward this time of year to the email from both of you of like, hey, John, we asked a whole bunch of people to be on the show and all of them turned it down. So I guess
it's not true at all.
No. I'm joking. It is always fun to talk with you, and it's always fun to kind of have this very relaxed kind of like, you know, just kind of bantering back and forth. And furthermore, I commend both of you. Like, I mean, being at the LF 10 years and kind of looking back and just like me just from a professional side, but also just like a personal side, you know, just, you know, 10 years ago, my oldest kid was in middle school, and now she's, you know, going to graduate college next month. so it's really interesting where time goes, but I commend both of you for the effort, the enthusiasm, the commitment, the working through the joys, working through the drudgery of doing something like this. I mean, it's hard work, and but it shows how committed you've really been to this overall big data community, especially as it sort of has transformed all the years. So I hats off to both of you for all this amazing work.
Thank you. Much appreciated. Yeah. And when it comes to the drudgery, definitely Jon has taken the brunt of that, mainly just dealing with me. But, you know, that's life. We all have our crosses to bear.
Yes. I mean, I have to earn my place in heaven or whatever it is that comes after this. And this is what my penance, let's say.
You must have been very, very bad in a previous life.
Let's not talk about that.
Oh, dear. Well, as I say, Jon, it's always a pleasure, and we've really, really appreciated these sessions with you over the years.
Yeah.
It's always been a huge amount of fun. The sort of rambling stream of consciousness kind of conversations that just weave in and out of
consciousness, to be on in rambling. It's, so yeah.
Yeah. It's always fun.
We all think things through, not me, but keep going.
It's always fun. It's always enjoyable. Yeah. It's always great to have an additional perspective on things, and it's like we never know where the conversation is going to go, but we know we're going to have a good discussion, which is
absolutely
like, you can't ask for anything better than that.
No, you can't. And I love the feedback from you. I mean, I remember a couple of years ago when we did the episode, going chapter by chapter through the book. I remember you guys were like flipping through it as, and we were having some really deep discussions on things, and actually many of those just very much hit on me as I was just beginning to think about things. I mean, one is like, oh shit, I probably should have wrote something different in the book, but two is just like kind of reflecting on like that level of being able to now have that next level of conversation and then take some of those things back. And many of these things that as I'm working with communities, I reflect back on. So, I mean, I think it's, you know, these personal interactions, you know, despite, you know, what social media has trained us to do to be keyboard warriors, you know, these are really what the valuable things are. And so I've really valued these conversations over the years. So thank you for letting me be a part of all of this.
Thank you.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. We absolutely do. Jon, any final words from you?
Nope. Bombshell has fallen, so I'm going to keep what I have to say for the next final episode.
All right. Well, again, Jon, thank you so much. And that is all the time we have for today. You can support this podcast. I mean, probably not for too much longer, I guess. But if you want to become a Patreon, yeah, for our final episode, every contribution really does help. You can also go to www.roaringelephant.org for a link to our Patreon page and for more information about the podcast, at least for a little bit longer. And you can still send feedback to podcast@roaringelephant.org. Again, at least for now. But until next time, my name is Bombshell Dave.
And my name is wishing the LF at least another 10 years. Jon.
I mean, I wish it at least another 10 years too. That way I can get closer to retirement, I suppose.
And with that, we look forward to talking to you at least one more time next week. Goodbye.
See you then.
Take care.